I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan. You may know me as a New York Times bestselling author of a book with an exploding pill on the cover, renegade psychiatrist, pole dancer, or honorary member of the Disinformation Dozen. What can I say? I'm a born provocateur. I've spent most of my recent life exposing deceptions, connecting dots, and discovering the secret places my inner victim is still waiting to be liberated. And now, I feel called to help you reclaim all of your parts, your health, your sexuality, your power, and your expression, so that you can finally truly own yourself. I want to ignite in you that inner knowing and the pulsing vitality that lives beneath your disempowerment, disconnection, and resentment, so that you can audaciously, courageously, and playfully alchemize your struggle into the specific pleasure of who you are. This is Reclamation Radio.
Hi, and welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and I am here with the one, the only, Dr. Steve Young, who is known by many identities, hats, and talents, including being a credentialed physicist, broken bad, and also an internationally renowned DJ and music alchemist, and most recently an author of the book A Fool's Wisdom, Science Conspiracies and the Secret Art of Alchemy. And I am so excited to dive in. This is going to be a very packed session because it's going to be part book report, which I am want to do with all of my tabs and quotes that I want to share, and also just a part, you know, storytelling about your experience from the world of academia and scientism, if we could just start to drop that term, into the realm of alchemy. So I'm so excited to be in conversation with you, Steve. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Kelly. It's an honor and a pleasure. Thrilled to be here and talk with you again, because I talked with you once before on your private network.
Sovereignty series. Yes, yes. And you were...
Yeah, I had some great people reach out to me after that, actually. Yeah, yeah.
Perfect. You were my chosen ambassador for the expose, I guess, on my personal research around cosmology. And I just feel like, as I am positioned to be something of a whistleblower for the mental health and medical industry, you know, you have this this very unique perspective on your training in physics and the ways in which you've come to questions. So let's just dive in, because you have often said and explained that there are scientific methods and, you know, means of inquiring into the nature of reality that bear fruit, is the phrase that you use. And there are some that don't. So there's science that you can do, and then there's science that you must believe. And as you deconstruct a lot of these different arms of science, you talk about these explanations that have come to be adopted by scientists, the scientific community, and even the population at large that aren't necessary to explain certain phenomena like gravity and nuclear weapons, et cetera. So we're going to get into those more specifically, but I just wanted to start really zoomed out, because I think as a philosopher and, you know, something of a polymath, I think that you have really started to connect some dots about like the nature of inquiry and the nature of the scientific method. So I'd love for you to unpack a little bit about what you mean by the sciences that bear fruit and those that don't.
Well, yeah, thanks. That's a great introduction and a great place to start. So yeah, so this, I mean, it really, it's a quote from the Bible, which says, ye shall know them by their fruits. That's it. Ye shall know them by their fruits, which is a quote from Jesus, I think. And, it's essentially telling that you can know about something, you can know something is good or bad by what it produces. And of course, when you first come into academia as a student and you're learning all these subjects, of course, you don't really know what is being produced from all this knowledge. You're just learning the knowledge in good faith that it will be useful to do things with in the future. You know, you're learning something that the world needs and, you know, something that can help you become successful and so on. But when I left with my PhD in theoretical physics, I found it very hard to find any meaningful work related to what I'd been studying It was mainly just, banking and military, essentially. You know, banks are the biggest employers of physics PhDs, are like investment banks and stuff like that, which when you've been learning about like atoms and, you know, nuclei and stuff, the idea of like going and working for a bank is just like really, you know, boring. And so I didn't want to do that. And so I was unemployed for 6 months after the PhD. And I tried applying to all kinds of employers and then ended up getting a job at a technical consultancy working for banks in the end. But so then as the years went on, so it's been over 20 years now since I finished the PhD, you know, I kept abreast of what's happening. I kept studying, kept learning. As I got more distant from academia, I started to notice that, you know, nothing's really coming from it. You know, there's all this knowledge that's talked about, but what's actually produced by it, you know, what is made from it, is there any benefits or applications to humanity? And, you know, in the case of the physics I was studying, like the nuclear and quantum and gravity and relativity and all these, I increasingly found that there were no applications of them. Now, in the case of quantum and atomic physics, there are said to be a number of applications, the atomic bomb being one of them, but other things like the electron microscope or MRI scanners or things like this, they're said to be, you know, things that came about because of our knowledge of atoms and because of our knowledge of quantum physics. But as I looked into all these alleged applications of quantum physics, I found that they were easily explained just in engineering terms. And in fact, they're just products of engineering, electromagnetic engineering. You know, technology has gotten better and better because people are doing it over and over again, you know, and repetition is like the mother of invention, right? So the more you do work repeatedly, you think of better ways to do it more efficiently and, you know, faster and smaller and all this kind of thing. So technology, all of it is born from engineering. And I found wasn't really an application of atomic physics or so on. And then, yeah, I mean, there's various other theories like this as well. So that's how I started to look at it. I realized there is all this good science that you can do, you know, classical physics, which is the classical physics is the root of all like technology and engineering and software and all this kind of stuff. But there's this whole new physics, which most of which came about in the last century. And some of it, you know, as far back as Newton, say, but really in the last few hundred years, there's a new type of physics which has taken over all physics, you know, programming, really. You know, you don't see people talking much about classical physics, but they're always talking about atoms and black holes and gravity and all this stuff, right? And I was sucked into that, you know, when I got to university, I was like, oh, this is where it's at. The new physics is this is our future. But yeah, as the years have gone on, I've just found that it's just not standing up to scrutiny and it's not produced anything good for humanity.
So I want to get into this in a little bit, but one of the most delightful aspects of reading this book was resolving the chronic annoyance that I have felt with the New Age and all of these different spiritual teachers referencing quantum physics and referencing all of these, you know, space holder terms that really mean almost nothing. Like you could use descriptive language instead of invoking these scientific theories. But it's like they borrow things like quantum entanglement or different aspects of, you know, the vernacular of quantum physics to substantiate their, you know, spiritual teachings and to validate, right? So we know, you and I, because I didn't mention this, but you are in a very small trusted circle of allies that I call on to help me interpret reality, right? So in our little circle of colleagues, you know, we talk about scientism and the religion of science and the way that it seems to serve a certain kind of consciousness. So in this book, you talk about five elemental theories that comprise the worldview of scientism. I'm just going to list them off because I want to start with this atomism, which I've never really thought to start there, right? Because I was very focused on some of the other ones that we'll touch on here. So the first is atomism, right? So things like atomic, nuclear, quantum, and particle physics. The second is gravity. Things that reference like Newton and Einstein and Hawking. The third is heliocentrism. So a lot of people may have never even heard that term. So it's sun centrism, right? So this solar system model. So the invocation of names like Copernicus and Galileo. I think of like that Indigo Girls song I used to sing all the time, like in high school. Oh my God, so funny how penetrant these things are. Number four is evolution. So the reference to Darwin. And the fifth, of course, is where, you know, I've spent a lot of my recent years is germ theory. So Pasteur and, you know, this concept that germs cause, or these invisible particles, you know, like viruses cause disease. So in those five arenas, you have connected some pretty important dots around, you know, the deception that has led to our being arrested in victim consciousness and powerlessness and a kind of dependency on these authorities who are, you know, really hand waving, right? So who are fabricating this fruitless science, right? This science that can't be necessarily seen with the naked eye and instead has to be rendered through mathematical equations, you know, and assumptions. So let's start with this concept of the atomic age, because the reference even to, you know, nuclear bombs and weapons, I mean, it's so reflexively assumed that that's a real risk, right? That is something, you know, we could just push a button and be gone, right? By so many colloquially that it's amazing to imagine we walk this plane with that, when you believe that, with that white noise of fear. And of course, I think that's, you know, what you and I have come to conclude is like, you know, when you shift your beliefs around these things, you shed so many, you know, of these deep existential worries. They just stop being relevant, right? So, but the way that you've talked about like electrons and protons and neutrons and this concept of atomism and how it then tracks forward into our perspectives on the solar system and our perspectives on so much of what we understand about reality really comes in sharp contrast to your specific training. So maybe we can start there and, you know, just start to introduce people to this idea of the atom as a fallacy and everything that's come from that.
Yeah, I suppose I did when I was at university, I did one module on philosophy of science, you know, as well as all the science stuff. I did one module in the philosophy department, and I was interested in the philosophical side of things. And there was a lot of philosophical stuff comes out from quantum mechanics and relativity and stuff. So I did a bit of that at university. And then when I left, I mean, I feel like that was almost like the most useful part, you know, because it took me like outside of the theories. It helped me to kind of like look at them and what they mean and understand that every theory has a corresponding philosophy. You know, if it doesn't have a practice, like, I mean, like music has a practice, you know, music is a theory. And every part of music theory has a corresponding practice, something you can do and apply. But if it's a theory that doesn't have a practice, it's usually it's an encoded philosophy or like a worldview or a creed, you might say, rather than philosophy. It's more like a creed, like a way of a system of belief. And with the atomism, so atomism goes way back, so they say, to Greek times, like Democritus, they say, was the founder of atomism. Now, I recently learned that like none of Democritus's original works or writings exist. So I'm sort of thinking he might even be just made up to like take the fall for this. I'm not sure. But no, a lot has been written about ancient Greek atomists. And the thing is, they were, you know, if you think about what they're actually proposing is that everything in the universe is made from these indivisible atoms, the word atom meaning indivisible. And from that then, you know, it poses a problem because it's a rejection of religion and God and all that for a start. You know, you're proposing a new model of the cosmos. And so, well, the atomists were associated with deep hedonism, basically. They were really into hedonism, and the atomic way of looking at things sort of rejected morality. And there is this idea that, like, if there's no God and it's all just atoms floating around in space, then where does goodness come from? And like they believed, well, goodness came from the bumping of atoms, right? Because if atoms are separated in space, they're lonely, they're isolated, and that's not good. But when they come together, you know, and touch, that's good. So it was associated with hedonism and, you know, lack of like decency and moral principles and so on, like abandoning morality and decency and everything. So They don't teach you that in physics class, of course, but, you know, that has been written about a lot. You know, this was kind of like the philosophy behind atomism. Yeah. And then from that, you know, I started to see how it does create this, well, there's this materialism, right? This idea that you're just this lone, you know, atom or collection of atoms that's just like come together. And of course, on this lonely planet and everything. And the atomic theory, well, I mean, we could talk about the alchemy bit soon as well, I guess, but the atomic theory is actually directly opposed to alchemy, the ancient science of alchemy, which says that everything is made from ether. And there's this like diametrically opposing worldview between everything being made from ether or everything being made from atoms. When you consider everything being made from atoms, it's a materialistic worldview in which everything is separate. But when you talk about ether, it's a holistic worldview where everything is connected and part of one single substance, which is more in line with the religious view of things, that we're all part of one, you know, one thing or one creator or universe or so on. So, yeah, so the atomism, even though it's 2,500 years old as an idea or whatever, it only really came to the forefront of physics in the last like 100-150 years or so, you know, and now it's just, as physics education is all about atoms. But as I say, you know, is anyone actually working with atoms? Is anyone actually using them or building anything with atoms? I don't believe so. I've been looking for a long, long time to see if anyone is actually using atoms, you know, for anything. But I think they just exist on the blackboard, you know, in the textbooks.
And so these concepts that are, again, like colloquially penetrant, like electrons and protons, this like dark matter, you know, sort of idea, the phenomenology of the impact of the observer. And, you know, it's funny to me that totally non-scientifically oriented folks are like talking about the, you know, these experiments, you know, that have theoretically been done in the realm of quantum physics to substantiate a lot of esoteric concepts. And so what you're saying is that based on your research, you haven't come to understand them as having ever been actually substantiated, actually proven, and they're just ideas.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the whole thing with, you know, modern atomism, which would be quantum physics, is this wave particle thing where they say, oh, the particle is sometimes a wave and the wave is sometimes a particle, and they can do all this, you know, crazy stuff. And, you know, they call it a paradox. And, you know, for me, when I started getting into alchemy, which, you know, again, we, you know, just views the world as consisting of four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, which I found can explain everything. You can explain everything in terms of earth, air, fire, and water, like no exceptions. So the wave particle duality just goes away because there's no particles. It's just fire. Like the light is just a wave, you know, a light wave, fire. And the paradox was because they were believing everything to be made from these little particles, right? So that's what introduced the paradox and made all these crazy things happen, is because they are believing that the fundamental reality is the particle in those experiments. But actually, I would say it's just light waves, you know, fire.
Our world is so full of noise. Politics, social media, other people's expectations, societal standards, judgments. It can be super challenging to access yourself and the wisdom of your hearts, your inner compass, and that quiet place inside that is always okay. I love the mist, elixir, and anointing oil called Quiet Mind by Lotus Way. It just transports me to this space of clarity, focus. It gives me the capacity to pause, and it's become something of a conditioned ritual that every time I reach for one of these bottles, I am able to open up in such a fast way, whether I'm intentionally meditating or just need to pattern disrupt some disembodied moments in my life. If this is appealing to you, I would love to invite you to head over to lotusway.com. Use the code KELLY15 for 15% off. The link is in show notes for you.
So I want to, on those five elements, I want to touch on like the grand implication, right? So if this is the case, that there have been a lot of assumptions made about the validity of this atomic theory, one of the great implications is that the splitting of the atom and these nuclear weapons are what, a hoax, right? Are fictitious history, are a psychological operation, are somehow a deliberate misrepresentation of what actually has occurred. And we are not necessarily living in a world where we are under threat of nuclear weapons. Like, would you say that's one of the implications?
Yes. Yeah. So the, you know, there's obviously big bombs. And I say that in the book, you know, I call them like BFBs, like big fucking bombs, you know, because as far as I understand, there's actually no limit to how big of a bomb you could make. You know, if you have lots of money and lots of explosives, then you can make a bomb as big as you can imagine, right? So I'm not saying that there's no big bombs. The question, of course, is whether the word nuclear or atomic is actually justified to put in front of the bomb when you say it's a nuclear bomb or whatever. I think when you really get to the core of atomic physics and like debunk that the atomic model and so on, you know, there's no reason to believe that the bombs are anything but an explosion, you know, of chemicals. And there was a guy, I believe Michael Palmer, did a whole study into this and claimed that it was napalm and mustard gas that they used. Although, you know, in the official story, they say it was uranium and plutonium. In the book, I debunk the official story and you know, show that, you know, uranium is not what we've been told either. And it doesn't require quantum or atomic physics to explain uranium. And, you know, so I think that's it. It's like, yes, there was obviously an explosion and, you know, they can make big bombs. But is it right to call them nuclear or atomic, or are they just big fucking bombs? And I think, you know, they're just big fucking bombs. And that's the end of it. The nuclear and atomic makes them sound scarier, right? It makes them sound like they have some, you know, magical science forces behind them. But emotionally, who gives a crap? It's like, it's just a big bomb going to kill everybody. You know, that's it. It's like, who cares if it's atomic or nuclear? It, you know, the idea that that's supposed to make a difference, you know, it's just a scare tactic, I believe. And so we have this whole atomic age, you know, we're said to be in the atomic age, which started in 1945 or perhaps 1941, they say, the first experiment or whatever. But really it started with the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings. And then there was this idea that, okay, at any moment in any part of the world, you know, some maniac could just destroy everything with a blast. And that's a really scary thing to take on, you know, as a young child. And you had all those kids with the duck and cover drills, you know, they duck under your desk and everything. But, you know, it's, yeah, I don't believe it at all. I don't think man has the power to destroy the world. And, you know, I don't believe the bombs are nuclear or atomic in any way at all. They're just big, big bombs, you know?
So relatedly, I want to read a quote to bring us to the gravity and heliocentrism arena. So you write, heliocentrism and the globe theory go hand in hand. They are constructed from atomistic thinking and the theory of gravity. The model of the solar system and the model of the atom are nearly identical. Even the most inattentive physics student notices this. The only real difference between the solar system and the atom is the scale of object being theorized. One is unimaginably big and the other is unimaginably small. So we we have extensively explored the whole cosmology piece. And I think the significance of this, right? So you call it, it's the mother of all conspiracies about the mother, right? About the nature of this realm that we live in. And so many people, and I was one of these people initially too, when I encountered the concept of an alternative model of the solar system, shall we say. It was actually through David Wolf, the first time that I heard him, we were doing an interview together. And the first time that I heard him talking about, you know, lines of sight that wouldn't be possible on a curved globe, I was like, who fucking cares? Shut up. But like, why does it matter? And the why does it matter reflex is very strong, right? Because it doesn't seem to have implications whether we're on a flat, motionless plane or whether we're spinning in the middle of nowhere on a dead rock, having exploded from, you know, some arbitrary moment of, you know, Big Bang history. And the implications for and around believing in gravity and believing that we are the third rock, you know, from the sun, are enormous, right? Metaphysically, spiritually, and I think both of us would attest to what gets lifted off of your spirit when you awaken to the manipulation around this. And the connection, right, between these two, even symbolically, which you're referencing in this quote, is extraordinary. So you talk about how to keep this inquiry simple, right? You talk about the proof of spinning, right? The proof that we're spinning and the proof of curvature being like the points of entry if anyone is curious about, you know, exploring the nature of this realm and whether or not we are in a closed system that is motionless and, you know, quote unquote flat, or whether it is the case that, you know, we're spinning around and water is sticking to a ball that we are, you know, scattered around. So if you could talk a little bit about like how you came upon this point of inquiry, because I know this is one of your first, in the journey, like it was a big point of entry for you. Yeah. And the connection then to your training in nuclear physics and just how it all seems to be a similar story.
Yeah. So, I mean, the flat earth stuff was, yeah, probably the first stuff I was looking at that was criticizing physics. And so, I mean, if you look at like the five theories that you listed earlier, you know, the flat earth stuff is pretty much all aimed at gravity and heliocentrism. You know, it's lumped into flat earth content, but actually it's all criticisms of the theory of gravity and the theory of heliocentrism. And that's it, you know. And, you know, why shouldn't these theories be criticized? You know, they're new theories, you know. And I, you know, at school, we should have been, I feel like we should have been taught like the criticisms against these theories, but we're not. We're taught the theories as if they are settled, like settled long ago by an important group of, you know, people, and you weren't at the meeting, but it's, you know, they settled it, you know, it's fine, you know, just believe it, you know, it's that kind of thing. Yeah, so the challenges against gravity, I mean, it came quite easily to me, actually. I mean, gravity is a strange one. It is always a strange one in physics. It's like, you know, they say it doesn't fit with quantum physics and stuff. And it went, obviously, from Newton's theory into Einstein's relativity. And, you know, that's very complex. And, you know, so the idea that gravity is just a theory was actually quite simple to accept. But then when you take that on and you really just like let that sink in, the implications of gravity not being real are just like massive, because the whole cosmos that we've been taught is actually constructed on the assumption that every light you see in the sky is like bound to every other object through this force of gravity. So gravity is literally the linchpin that holds the entire cosmos together. And gravity is also needed for the ball Earth to be real as well. Like why would we be on a ball if it wasn't for, you know, the force of gravity pulling everything towards the center and creating this like ball in space or whatever. So yeah, and then actually like they have this whole history of the universe that they call the Big Bang and evolution and stuff. And that's all based on gravity as well. The whole model, it's like everything, it's, you know, they have used gravity as the creator almost. You know, gravity is what pulled all the matter together, right? And made it into something good. You know, it's like almost like the creator, you know. Yeah, so then this calls into question the model of the solar system. So the idea of the sun with the planets going around it, which, as you said from my book, is just like the model of the atom, where you have the nucleus with the electrons going around it. And, you know, the sun is said to be a nuclear, you know, furnace, basically a nuclear reactor. So you have the nucleus of the atom, which is a nuclear force, and then you have the sun, which is also nuclear. And the sun is said to be the biggest source of gravity as well. And also the atomic nucleus is said to be the biggest source of mass, which is where the gravity comes from. So I just see this just this like one-to-one correspondence between the solar system and the atom. And they're both models, you know, they're models where there's a big ball with lots of other balls spinning around it with no strings attached, right? Nothing attached to them, just all doing that in space. And, you know, we just don't observe that kind of thing happening in normal reality. Now, yes, we look to the sky, we see the stars going round, but actually, you know, we don't need a model of the stars to predict what they're going to do. Like, all you need to do is measure the timings of the planets, right? Like for astrology, for like predicting eclipses and stuff like that. If you want to predict eclipse, you know, 1,000 years in the future, you don't actually need a model of the solar system to do that. You just need accurate measurements of how long each object takes to go around the sky. And, you know, the ancient astronomers knew this. They were observing keenly and, you know, marking like how long each thing takes. And that's how they're able to make astrological predictions way in the future. They didn't need a model to do that. And so, you know, a lot of people think, you know, heliocentrism is how we're able to predict eclipses, right? That's nonsense, right? It's like they've known that for ages, just timing, you know, it's just working out the timing of things. So, yeah, so really then all that stuff kind of falls apart. And, you know, to be honest, the flat Earth, like people, you know, the people who really came out and put themselves out there, you know, your Dave Weiss and Eric Dubay and all these guys, they made masses and masses of content and loads of other great channels. Well, they did an absolutely fantastic job. You know, if the internet was academia, right, that they would have, it would be settled, right? But the internet is not academia. Like, academia just carries on its path, regardless of what any independent people are uncovering online. And, you know, that, so that was another thing that became clear, particularly in recent years, with all the injections and everything. Like, it was clear that, you know, academia and the establishment, they just keep on going down this path of scientism, no matter what anybody else uncovers online. And I thought that was quite disturbing, because we got that sense on the internet that we're all figuring this out together. And they're just, you know, they're just like, no, we're not, we don't listen to you. Like, we're doing our own thing, no matter what anybody on the internet discovers. So yeah, so that was a big eye opener. And as I say, all that came before I started looking into the atomic and nuclear stuff again, you know. And ultimately, I realized the atomic and nuclear was actually my, you know, that's my specialty, you know, the flat Earth guys and all that. They've covered it. You know, there's nothing I can say about flat Earth that hasn't already been said. You know, I'm merely just reflecting back, you know, the fact that I agree with, you know, the flat Earth movement and their criticisms of heliocentrism and gravity. And I think it's absolutely a conversation worth having, even though many people don't, right? They think you, basically, if you even think about flat Earth, you're not worth talking to, right? That's the prevailing belief. But, you know, it's a group of people who are growing in number constantly, right? Because nobody ever goes back. And I think there's this like sort of unidirectionality to like truth and awakening, right? With things like flat Earth and vaccines and stuff like that. It's like once you go, you don't go back, you know, no one goes back to like getting the injections, right? Or, you know, it is a one-way street. And, you know, and that is real, you know. People wake up, they don't go back. And I guess that's an important thing to consider when you're looking at all this. It's like, you know, it's like no one actually goes, oops, I was wrong, and goes back. They don't do it. It's like, because you're actually in a better position. You're in a more enlightened, more illumined place with a better grasp and a better understanding of things. So why would you go back to a more ignorant position? It just doesn't make sense. So I think just with everything that's happened in recent years, like the whole scientism industry, that the connection between all these different departments, you know, the medical and the physics and all that, like, yeah, it just became clear that it was all part of one thing, you know? Yeah, like one mindset or an egregore.
Exactly. And they all seem to have in common what we discussed earlier, which is the lack of utility and necessity of these theories to explain our lived experience, right? So, you know, it's not that you're saying things don't fall to the ground. It's that the concept of gravity isn't necessary to explain what density and buoyancy can explain, right? And the logical fallacies that abound in these realms are often exposed by the fact that there were these claims made, right? These claims that it's not actually how we had historically or ancestrally thought it was, right? No, it's actually this way. It's not, you know, an enclosed system that virtually every, you know, traditional society seemed to represent the world as being. No, it's a globe and it's spinning and it's, you know, in this orientation to these other actual mass containing bodies. And that assertion is what requires the evidence, right? Rather than the defense of what already was the conclusion based on our observed experience, right? So when these new scientific theories are posited, the burden of proof is on, you know, the proclamation, right? Is on these concepts. And that's what you break down in the book. And of course, these other, you know, thought leaders that you're referencing have deconstructed ad nauseam, right? It's like, no, the actual proof doesn't exist for your positive assertion. And there actually isn't a need to prove otherwise. You know, the default, right? So when you claim something is different, you're the one who has to prove that it is in fact different, right?
I have to thank you guys for that. Sorry, just let me thank you and the other sort of like people who opened my mind to germ theory and viruses and all that, because, you know, I got that from you guys that the person making the positive claim, you know, the burden of proof is on them. And you're perfectly within your rights to say there's no viruses, there's no electrons, there's no gravity, because there literally is no viruses, no electrons and gravity anywhere for anyone to see, right? So it's the person who says that it is there. They need to have the proof, right? We don't need to disprove it. They need to prove it. And as we've seen, yeah, they haven't, you know, so they haven't proved
right.
it. So.
Exactly. Just yeah. right. Just like if you say, you know, we evolved and changed form from monkeys, right? That's up to you to prove that, right? Yeah. Because that, you know, there are all sorts of assertions you can make. And in fact, what we find when we actually do the digging is the proof isn't there. But the replacement fallacy that suggests, okay, well, if it's not this, then you tell me what it is one of these traps, you know, that even in discussion, we can get baited into, right? If it's not a virus, an invisible particle causing human illness, then what is it? Well, in fact, that replacement theory is not necessary to have a scientifically rigorous exploration, right? And that's where this burden of proof on the novel claim comes in. So I want to read this list because I think it's a really satisfying list. It's about a page and a half long, which is the key implications of the globe hoax, right? So there are many places to go down the rabbit hole if you're curious about this, but this is like a really great summary. So you write, every picture video model of the globe Earth is a fabrication. Globes are not for educational purposes, as they say, right? If you flip one over in a kindergarten classroom, that's what it says. The ocean horizon line is always observed to be flat, level. Ships that disappear over the horizon are seen again with zoom lenses, which is often one of the assertions, right? Like, oh, they're going over the curve. No, not really. The stated curvature of 8 inches per mile squared is not in fact observed, right? Which means that we can actually see things we shouldn't be able to see. The Earth is not a planet or an object. It's the ground. It's your flesh. The North Pole is the center of the realm, not the sun. Gleason's map provides the best view of the territory. The great ocean is flat like a giant circular puddle. Antarctica is an ice shelf surrounding the edge of the puddle. The land is stationary and immovable within the water. North is in and south is out. East is anticlockwise and west is clockwise. Sun and moon move in spiral paths above the Earth plane. Gravity is fictitious. Nobody landed on the moon. It's not a land. There are no orbiting satellites, just balloons, drones, and aircraft. NASA weightless videos are filmed in Vomit Comet aircraft. Astronauts are bad actors, liars, and counterintelligence agents. Rockets are fireworks. There is no Tesla in space and no telescopes either. There is no outer space. It's all inner space. Pressurized air implies we're in a hermetically sealed container. That's a huge one, right? Like you can't have, you know, propulsion and these things that ostensibly are available in so-called outer space without a closed container. Stars are not nuclear and they're not millions of light years away. Planets are not lands. They can't be landed on or conquered. Nobody is going to Mars on a rocket. Mars is not a land. President Nixon didn't phone the moon from a rotary dial in 1969. And the Space Force is a space farce. So that is quite a list of the implications.
Yeah, it's a non-exhaustive list, I must say.
Right, exactly.
There's so much more, isn't there?
And so, yeah, to just touch on the last two, you know, I'd love to hear what you feel are the implications of debunking, if we want to use that term, evolutionary theory and germ theory. Like, what are the implications? Who cares whether, you know, our history as a species is as we've been told. And, you know, we crawled out of the water and then turned into a monkey and then some magical day, you know, turned into a human. You know, is it that the Christians were right this whole time? You know, what are the implications of letting go of this theory that doesn't seem to have the evidence to back it up that it would require as a positive assertion? And, you know, and what do you take away from germ theory not being true?
Well, I got a great deal of power from learning all about germ theory, which I, you know, really knew nothing about until 2020. Sort of like, I was like, I really have to start looking into this now. But I mean, to go start with evolution, because germ theory kind of comes out from that. But with evolution, it's... You know, it's obviously quite an incredible thing to believe anyway, like, you know, just all like the transmutation of species and everything and all these long time frames and the trial and error and, you know, your cousins being monkeys and all that kind of stuff. But really what I found like most, where I find most opposition with it is it's actually opposed to creation. And like the big, there was the big debate back in, I think, the 90s of evolution versus creationism. And I wasn't paying too much attention to it at that time, but I remember it was coming up. I think it was a big debate in the States and maybe on the media and stuff like that. Like, should schools teach kids that we evolved, or should they teach them that we were created? Anyway, back at that time, I had my head in physics. I wasn't really thinking about this stuff. But as I came, you know, as to be an artist, like a professional artist, I was appreciating art and appreciating nature. You know, looking in detail at nature's designs and patterns and so on is like part of how I get my inspiration. And, you know, I just started to see how evolution is totally opposed to the idea of creation itself. So, you know, the idea of even creativity, you know, because it's like, well, where did creativity come from if we all just evolved? You know, you're sort of, because you're saying that the universe didn't create us, but somehow we are capable of creating things, you know, like the universe created creative beings, or the universe evolved creative beings. It's just a very strange thing to believe. And when I look at nature, I see it's like the highest art, you know. It's like, so the designs are so perfect. The human body, for example, and, you know, plants and animals and everything are just so perfect in their artistic design. And I came into a very much a creationist point of view. And, you know, it wasn't just like, I mean, I did read the Bible. I did start reading the Bible about like 5-6 years ago, but it wasn't just that. It was just like, I just felt like, you know, I am a created being. Like, I've been created by a creator. And so as everything else natural in this world is perfect, but everything created by man is imperfect or temporary, you know, but all the nature, all the things created by God, as it were, are perfect and everlasting. And so I just really began to see this dichotomy. And then, you know, evolution, I have a chapter on it, although it's one of the smaller chapters. There's a lot that can be said about it, but, you know, I didn't go into it in too much depth. It's really just a philosophical point I have with it, you know, where it's opposed to creation and creativity, which as an artist, you know, it's kind of offensive in that sense. Like, imagine somebody, you know, in the future, like 100 years in the future, or 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years in the future, finds, you know, my music. And they're listening to it, and then they're like, "Well, where did this come from? How did this come about?" And if they were to say, "Well, it evolved," you know, it's just the idea, you know, that a piece of music evolved is just ludicrous, right? You know, it's so the idea that the human being evolved, or that any other of these like perfect works of creation that they just came about through some like fumbling of atoms. And it all comes back to atoms in the end, because once you get rid of the creator, there's nothing left but atoms, right? So the atoms are the substance of creation, but they're also the creator. Like, it was made not just from atoms, but by atoms. You know, that's in the scientific view, everything is made by atoms. It's like the atoms just did it all by themselves. They were just flapping around, you know, on the space rocks and, you know, joining together to make molecules and so on, and just like build it up like that. But, you know, it's all entirely theoretical, based on, you know, sketchy like mathematical theories and stuff like that. It's just not something we see in reality. What we see is that, you know, we are creative beings. Like, you know, we're human beings are like the ultimate like creative like workers. You know, we can build anything, we can do anything, we can conceive of anything. And, you know, it said we're made in the divine image. And so I believe that's we're able to create because the divine is able to create. and we're made in the divine image. We have that edge over animals, you know, and that kind of creative edge. I mean, from there then, well, with germ theory, so I know a lot of, in science, like people like to stick to their lane, right? If like, if you're a medical guy, you only talk about medicine, you don't talk about physics and so on. And as a physicist, I'm like, oh, how can I say anything about medicine or biology? You know, I'm not a biologist, but, you know, it's such a big thing that affected us all. And it actually, you know, I realized when I started looking into virus theory, I realized that, well, virus is a quantum thing. Like, it's actually in my domain. So even though it sounds like the virus is the domain of medicine and doctors and so on, actually, when you look at really what they're described as being, it's supposed to be a collection of 5 million atoms together in this like cluster, like this kind of like super molecule thing. So that actually puts it well within my grasp as an atomic scientist. And so, yeah, I found just the more I thought about viruses and looked into the theory, it just seemed like it was just always just getting further and further away. You know, you're never actually getting to the thing, right? Because there is no thing. It's an idea that's, you know, just made up and is like actually based on all those other theories, based on evolution, based on atomism. So I started to develop this kind of zoomed out perspective at that point. And this was really just in the last few years, you know, as starting to write the book and talking with yourself and the other people we've spoken to in our group. It's like a sort of multidisciplinary group of people who've been questioning their fields and also, you know, questioning the general scientific consensus. And yeah, so I saw like virus has almost been like the cherry on top of this whole structure of science that goes back, you know, a few hundred years. And then where did it all lead in the end, right? What's the fruit of all of that? It was the needle, right? The injection. That was the thing. That's the physical, you know, all of this thought. Where is it all leading? It's all leading towards all of you have to take this needle in your arm or you're not going to get your life back, right? And for me, that's not a fruit. that's not the fruits of science, right? That's actually like an evil plan, you know, and it's just, yeah. So it really just brought it all together for me, all of it. And you know, was really the inspiration for the book in the end, was like sort of making this framework and then debunking it all and showing people that there is, in fact, ancient science that explains everything. So none of that stuff was even needed to begin with. It's all just misguided human activity. You know, ultimately, all that science is just misguided human activity. It doesn't produce anything, doesn't help anyone, costs lots of money, you know, and of course, people's careers are like wrapped up in it, right? Like, you know, we can sit here and like talk about it and everything, but people who are actually, you know, have a paid job to talk about that thing, they're going to defend it because their whole career and life is on the line. And, you know, they're getting paid, you know, they have a cushy job to just come and all they have to do is like talk about physics and defend it or whatever. They don't have to produce anything. They don't have to make anything. They just have to hold it down by just talking about it over and over again. I see as a lot of these like celebrity physicists and stuff, that's all they do is they just talk about what's in the textbooks, you know, ad nauseum and never question any of it. Like, so yeah, so I had to just give it all I've got in the book, really. Like, didn't pull any punches. Just like, you know what? I mean, after the last 4 years, it's like the gloves are off, right? It's like, if I'd written this book like earlier, I would have been super polite and just like, you know, tiptoeing. But you know, I thought after like what the science world has done to me in the last few years, just been an absolute assault of like nonsense, bad theories, pseudoscience, like, you know, evil, all sorts of things all messed up in this scientism worldview. I thought I can't hold back now. Like, I really got to just let loose and, you know, debunk it as hard as I can.
So people love to ask me questions, and I love to ask questions of others because inquiry is play. But some of my interviews and answers are too hot to handle for Reclamation Radio. So in my membership Vital Life Project, I have created a private podcast that gets delivered to wherever you listen to podcasts, where I answer your questions that arise because of my provocative subject matter. And I also share interviews that might otherwise be censored that I call the Sovereignty Series. So you'll get access to these private podcasts and a private chat by joining my membership, Vital Life Project. I'll see you in there.
It's also the nature, right, of the game that folks like you and I have elected to play.
in this polarity, right? Like having been card-carrying cult members of the Church of Scientism to explore this antithetical polarity, it's a unique experience. It's fun, you know? Like there's something really ultimately enlivening if we can look beyond this idea that it's being, that all of these deceptions are being, you know, forced upon us, you know? Because when I consider all of the different arenas that you highlight and all of the dots that you connect in this book, I look at, you know, these concepts like mutations, right? In the evolutionary theory, right? It's just like random mutations that get you to, you know, having 10 fingers and 10 toes. Or in viral theory, it's like these randomly mutating, you know, particles that have this lethal potential. You know, the cosmological theories and the atomistic theories, like they're the random universe that is just happening to you versus this experience being ordained and a very specific gift to you, right? Depending on what you believe, from you to you, is it leaves us in a very different energy potentially and with a very different locus of power and life force. So I wonder what you would say is, you know, what is the best feeling part of everything that you've awakened to, would you say, in summary, I guess?
That's a good question. You know, I mean, when people write to me and say they've read my book and it's really transformed their worldview, you know, it feels amazing. I've had a lot of emails like that recently, you know, including my own cousin, you know, who said he had a total, complete worldview transformation, like reading the book. You know, that feels good because I, you know, I tried talking to people. I'm not the most outspoken on social media, but, you know, I tried talking to people in person for a lot of years and stuff, and I never really had much joy, like getting through to people and stuff. So I developed this sort of like internal dialogue that I'm never going to change anybody's mind about anything. You know, people are just so stubborn and stuck in their ways. They're never going to listen to me. Like, what the hell, you know? But then, of course, when you write a book and you actually put some effort into like making a case, you know, and making a thesis as I did, of course, that's something that really can transform people. You know, it's because I've given them the whole picture. You know, I'm not just spitting out opinions on this and that. It's like I've actually just like given a whole story and a whole picture. And it's tied in with my life as well, you know. And I remember there's something you said to me about this idea that the medium is the message. You know, when you think about writing a science book, in academia, you're taught to be like super objective, right? And just write about the science. Never use the word I. Don't talk about yourself, right? And I think that's a problem, right? Because then you don't know anything about the person who did the work, right? And it's like, as we find out, like loads of, you know, a lot of these like quantum physicists were like pedophiles and stuff, you know, like Schrodinger and that. But, you know, but they don't tell you that at uni, and they didn't, you know, they're not writing about their life in their like scientific papers, you know? So I thought, no, I have to write about my life and the transformation that I've gone through as someone who was in that world coming to where I am now. And that's really the transformative power. You know, if I had just written like a book of facts with nothing about me, but just all like objective facts, like it would be boring. And, you know, yeah, you know, I think that's why a lot of these books, like propaganda books, right? That's how they're written, you know, textbooks. There's nothing about the author in the book at all. Right. It's just all about the subject. And so, yeah, like talking with you and other members in the group in that, yeah, really just gave me made me realize that, yeah, I have to put myself into the book as well to really give it that transformational power and help people to see that I've actually gone through a transformation. You know, I wasn't born a flat earther. You know, as people talk to you like that, don't you? When you question, they talk to you as if you were just like born a flat earther and you're like some like aberration, you know, or, abomination of nature or something. It's just like, no, I just believed everything you believe. Like, you know, maybe I believed it even deeper than you because I went like to, you know, PhD and Master of Science and all this. Like I went so deep into it. And then, you know, I've come out of it now. And yeah, it's a great feeling. I mean, you know, I don't know what the best feeling part of it is. I suppose it is just when somebody appreciates it, you know, when somebody actually reaches out to you and tells you how much they appreciate what you've done. I think for me is the best feeling part of it. Yeah.
So the entire second half of your book is on this subject. We're clearly not going to do it justice with this final question, but I want to just, you know, introduce folks to the progression from the resolution of these deceptions for you, which is alchemy, right? So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how alchemy brings your worldview into focus.
Yeah, well, so I'd been researching alchemy actually for years before I even looked into the flat earth stuff, and actually made it easier to grasp and less of a shock, I think, because I was looking at all these old alchemy texts, which were, you know, clearly based in a geocentric worldview, you know, and at first you're looking at it like a sort of curiosity, like, oh, long ago people believed, you know, in this like stationary enclosed world or whatever. But, you know, so I'd had a number of years looking at that and reading these books and these, you know, stuff from like 400 years ago, very well written, very intelligible, very high minded, you know, scientific and spiritual and compassionate. And, you know, these voices from the distant past that seem to be just like a higher, you know, spiritually and mentally, intellectually than really anything I was reading of modern times, you know. And so alchemy in essence is a worldview where everything is based on four elements: fire, earth, air, and water. It's, you know, commonly used all over the world, and it's in art and philosophy and religion. It's, you know, the basis of metals, you know, making metals and stuff like that is where all that came from. And I really found the more I looked into it, it was actually it's like the root of all science, you know. And they tell us in school that chemistry came from alchemy. And that's one of the lies they tell about alchemy, is they say that nothing good came from it except chemistry, right? It's like the alchemists were these mad scientists that were trying to make gold or whatever. And they never succeeded, but they did make, you know, test tubes and stuff like that, which we find useful today, you know. So the idea is that like chemistry is, you know, a product of alchemy. But actually, chemistry is alchemy with the spiritual aspect removed. So al is a spiritual term meaning the all or the one or the or God. So alchemy is like a spiritual science. Alchemists would work with materials. They would do like chemical work as we're doing. They would also work with music, also work with metals and so on, herbs, medicines and things. So they work with many different things, but yeah, all doing it through this, you know, this understanding of fire, earth, air, and water and being the core elements. Yeah, so I think then when I got to the flat earth stuff, it wasn't too much of a leap then to be like, okay, you know, this is a new idea. It came from the Catholic Church, from the Roman Catholic Church. It's where the heliocentrism came from. We know this, Copernicus, Galileo, all that stuff. And that church have had a huge influence on the world and the education and media and stuff like that, because the Roman church, they're conquerors, you know, they actually, that's what they do. They're like, they roam, right? The Romans roam. They spread themselves out and try to take over everything. And they've written about this. The Jesuits have written about this in their books, you know, how they move out and they try to take over all the education and everything like that. So yeah, it just became clear that, yeah, this is why we believe in all this heliocentrism, is because of the dominance of like Roman Catholic education in the world. But yeah, kind of rambling on a bit there, but I mean, I suppose just to end on that, I mean, it seems like they don't want people knowing about alchemy. But it's not like, it's not heavily censored though. It's just, it's there. They just won't tell you about it. So there's a sort of soft censorship with alchemy, not like the hard censorship like you've probably faced and, you know, others have faced now. When you're talking out against the narrative, it's like you get some like hard censorship. But alchemy is soft censored. In other words, it's there. There's loads of books on it, loads of places online. You're free to read all about it and practice it, but don't expect them to tell you about it. They'll keep it hidden. Yeah. And,
well, but that's why it's such a fun treasure hunt to come across, you know, books like yours, where we can begin to remember, right, these very beautiful frameworks and creative, expansive arenas for our understanding of what it is to be, you know, a human being. So I am so grateful, Steve, to call you an ally. And I know you're just getting started, you know, putting all of this out there in many different forms and beginning to ignite this remembrance for others. And yes, I did say that to you, that you as the medium, right? So not only because of your credentials, but because of your unique experience as a man, you know, you are likely to be the
the conduit for a lot of truth and remembrance for so many people. And I'm just really grateful. So we'll make sure to have the links and show notes for where people can find you and can check out this book, which has quickly become my go-to referral, you know, for anybody who is interested in, like, gently, I would say, gently awakening to so many of these tropes and so many of these, you know, seemingly tried and true ideas that have informed our, you know, our language and our, you know, conceptualization of, like, what the hell is going on here, right? And there's another way to look at it, and it feels so much better. That's the beautiful part about this journey. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me on, Kelly. Mm-hmm.